I'm John Krall. Today, on this special pre-recorded No Limits, we will have an in-depth conversation with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We will talk about what he has been doing since he left the Senate following the 2012 election. We will talk about today's intensely partisan political atmosphere, an atmosphere that brought about his defeat in a primary after 36 years in the Senate, and whether there are ways to make that atmosphere less bitter. And we, of course, will talk about the challenges America faces around the world with Lugar, one of the world's acknowledged foreign policy experts. We won't be taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets today, but please listen closely as we talk with a legendary figure in Indiana history, Richard Lugar. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar in a special pre-recorded conversation. We hope you will enjoy it. Senator Lugar, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Great to be with you.
It's been a little more than a year since you left the Senate, and you have not rested much since then. You've stayed very busy, so I'd like to bring folks up to date on what you are doing these days.
Well, with the help of my son, John Lugar, and my former chief of staff, Marty Morris, we established what is called the Lugar Center at 1717 Rhode Island in Washington, D.C., where we have former staff members who have come together to continue work on how to feed the world, that is, food and nutrition problems in America and abroad, and arms control problems and energy efficiency, things that I've been deeply interested in and that most Hoosiers have been interested in for a long time also. We've gotten some foundation support, that is, money grants from large foundations that have tied us over in terms of financing of these staff members who are doing their research. And it offers me a headquarters to do my work, which includes being a visiting professor at Indiana University and the University of Indianapolis and occasionally at Georgetown University, and a scholar with the German Marshall Fund. Germans set up the German Marshall Fund after the generosity of the United States, and it's an opportunity for me to visit periodically with maybe a dozen ambassadors for breakfast, or to visit their embassies and to talk about ways in which we can be more effective together. And then I've had a base for lectures in colleges all over America, at Duke, University of Tennessee, University of Texas, Northwestern, Harvard and Yale, and lots of interesting places, talking to students, learning from students, and likewise their faculties and the people who come to these lectures. So it's been a very vigorous year. Finally, I would just add that we've had three wonderful trips to South Korea, Azerbaijan, and Montenegro, sponsored by the governments of those countries, as well as certain business interests at home and abroad, in which I led fairly large delegations of other Americans and gave speeches and interviews and had meetings, learned a lot about those countries. Hopefully they learned a lot about ours, which will cement relationships.
Are you enjoying this new period in your life? And if so,
yes,
what
I
are
am.
You enjoying?
I think it's an opportunity to continue public service. And this has been the great opportunity for me since I finished my formal education. As you may recall, as a student at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, I went to the American Embassy in London, volunteered for service in the United States Navy, was on active duty for over 3 years, much of it as an intelligence briefer for then Chief of Naval Operations Arleigh Burke. And on coming back to Indianapolis to work with my brother Tom to strengthen our family factory out of Thomas O. Green and the Lugar Farm down in Decatur Township, within a few years, people on the west side came to me, asked me to run for the Board of School Commissioners in Indianapolis. And so this started 3 years with the school board, then 8 years as mayor of Indianapolis, a break for a year in which I taught as a visiting professor at the University of Indianapolis while I campaigned for the Senate, and 36 wonderful years in the United States Senate. So I've been able to continue that public service in ways that have at least enhanced what I learned while I was a senator or a mayor, and have been working in this country and in Indiana and around the world.
Do you miss the Senate?
Of course I miss the Senate. It was a wonderful opportunity, and I'm grateful to the citizens of Indiana for making it possible for me to have that opportunity. But it gave a chance for me to make some, working with others, vital reforms in agricultural programs, the Freedom to Farm program, which finally got rid of the limits that were imposed during New Deal days, allowed us to plant as much as we wanted on our land and whatever we wanted to plant, and to really utilize our facilities and our talents to the greatest. This was a tremendous revolution in agriculture, and I was grateful to have an opportunity to serve as chairman of the Agriculture Committee and work with others to try to effect this. And then with my partner, former Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, we had a great opportunity that came about through all sorts of circumstances to work with the Russians, literally to disarm them, to eliminate weapons of mass destruction, large missiles and warheads, various other destructive devices, for the better part of 20 years as I went back and forth to Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, all the places where these instruments of destruction aimed at the United States were being torn down, and tried to keep the appropriation process in the Congress going and the proper supervisory business. So these were huge opportunities to serve Indiana and to serve my country. And things I'm doing now are an attempt really to continue that work.
If you are just joining us, we are having a special one-on-one conversation with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We've been talking about his Senate career and what he has been doing since then. Senator, are there any parts of the Senate and really being involved in political life that you don't miss at this point, or which parts do you miss the least?
Well, I suppose that I miss the least the extreme partisanship that has developed. Clearly, historians would say there have been other times in American history when times were rough economically or because of other conflicts that people became excessively partisan. But this certainly qualifies as one of them, and it's an unfortunate situation. However, it's one of which you have to learn how to deal. And during the final years that I served in the United States Senate, and certainly things were very, very partisan in the Senate. But I attempted to work carefully with other members, regardless of their party or background, to try to bring back effective governance. And I think we were successful in a great number of ways, even in the midst of the partisanship. So I miss that aspect. I would say one of the things that occurred during the time I was in the Senate, and this is a matter of debate and will be with not only senators but constituents. Over the course of that time, senators no longer spent very much time with each other. By that I mean social events or events that brought families together, events even sometimes that brought senators together during their working hours to actually get to know each other, to develop some degree of trust, some background of understanding. This really has been missing now for a while, and it's become, I think, more difficult. Now, some members of the House of Representatives, I understand, I don't know if members of the Senate do this, but some members in the House, I understand, to make a point of the fact that they are not tied to Washington, do not even have apartments in Washington. They live in their Senate offices and use the gym facilities to wash up or what have you. A great number of members of the Senate and the House have what almost like fraternity houses, a whole raft of people in the House They plan to come in on Tuesday, leave on Thursday, and really want to be in Washington as little as possible. Now, that may reflect their feeling of constituents who want them back home, or maybe the senators and members of House themselves who don't like Washington. But it has not really enhanced good governance, because you really have to know people. You have to be able to talk to them, listen to them, sit down with them to be able to get the job done.
I remember after you were defeated in the primary in 2012, you issued a statement based on somewhat these lines, arguing that both parties were trapped in a cycle that inhibited good governance at that point, and any sort of discourse that might break impasses. I'd like to ask you a little bit about how you think we got there. What forces, obviously, you know, with 36 years in the Senate and a long history of public service even before you got to the Senate, what forces produced where we are right now?
Well, perhaps I was not as observant as I should have been of developments that were occurring with regard to the Senate or campaigns. But if I were to discuss this question with other senators now, they would say, get real. The problem for us is that there are large national groups that have scorecards. Mm-hmm. The scorecards are aimed at us. Are you for us or against us? Percentages of votes for or against. Now, in the event that you are voting against their interests, then they are prepared to put millions of dollars into your state or into your congressional district to defeat you through negative advertising, through grassroots activity, through whatever it takes. I really had not come to an appreciation of how forceful these national groups were going to become that do not necessarily have the interest of Indiana or any other place in mind, but have large doctrinal disputes with regard to big government taxes, budgets, or social issues. But this has become a very large reality in politics. And with the Supreme Court decision, which indicated that expenditures in political campaigns from everywhere could be unlimited, this has unleashed really what are national campaigns, spotting various candidates in various states and districts that should be exterminated for the good, at least, of the organization that is spending the money. That makes it more difficult, certainly, for current members who are up for re-election to have talks that verge on the philosophical or thoughtfulness about the future of America or anybody else. They are in a trap in which they understand that they are going to lose the election, going to be run over in the event they do not hew, at least, to these scorecards and to these interests. And I don't know the way out of that predicament. It could be, in due course, the public as a whole, which now registers very low marks for Congress. Some would say the lowest that anyone can ever remember since polling was occurring, may come to a conclusion that it's in the interest of grassroots people in Indiana or anywhere else in America not to be bound by the dictates of national organizations and money, but to sort of recapture their own members, to recapture their own politics. And I suspect we'll have an evolution to that, but for the moment, it is a very serious predicament for those who are facing re-election.
Is that what happened in your primary race against Richard Murdoch? I mean, I know that there were national organizations involved.
I have no way of analyzing all of that, and I don't want to really get into discussions on things I don't know a whole lot about. In other words, I was just simply very surprised of the national interest in the campaign. And the amount of money that came into the state very suddenly. And likewise, I suppose I was surprised that there was very little interest in the particular campaign in which I was involved. By that I mean very low turnout. That's often the case in primary elections, I understand, but it was a surprise, and perhaps I should not have been so surprised. Perhaps I should have been much more alert and prepared. I really prepared a very different kind of campaign, because at least 6 years before, I've had the good fortune that there was not even a Democratic nominee for the Senate to run against me. And we'd had margins of about two-thirds for two or three elections before that. So it was not a sense of overconfidence, but at the same time, I felt, at least in the early polling that we had, that there was still a fairly high approval of the work I was doing.
We are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar on this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits. We are not taking calls, emails, or tweets today, but we do hope you will stay with us. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar in this special edition of No Limits. Senator, before the break, we were talking about the spirit of partisanship that that sort of is dominating the political atmosphere these days, and I do want to get to talking about some of the foreign policy challenges in front of us and lean on your expertise in that area. But I'd like to explore just one other piece of that partisan puzzle and ask you, as someone who was in the middle of it, I mean, as I've been interviewing you on and off now ever since I was in high school many, many years ago, and you are generally one of the most moderate voices around. I don't think I've ever heard you resort to hyperbole of any kind. What personally was it like to be caught up in that kind of atmosphere? Was it just incredibly uncomfortable?
Well, it was disappointing. Obviously, not until the election was over did I realize precisely what the result was going to be. I always am optimistic and hopeful. And it appeared to me that, optimistic or hopeful or not, that I ought to remain positive throughout the campaign. I ought to try to retain what I felt was the goodwill of Hoosiers, the people with whom I had been working and visiting, at least for 36 years around the state of Indiana. And I felt it was very important that I maintain at least a constructive spirit, because even as I was running for re-election during those months of the primary, I was still hard at work in Washington, attempting to fashion, I felt, important legislation in regard to foreign policy and the physical security of our country, to continue the work on the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Bill, that is, to make certain that the Russians were continuing to make the adjustments, the destruction of their weapons that we had under treaty, and likewise to work with farmers, which I'm one in Indiana, to try to meet the challenges that were a part of that. So I continued to maintain, I hope, pretty close to a 100% roll call vote record. That had been my intent. I think by the time that I left the Senate, I'd reached the point of being either 11th or 12th in the batting order historically of United States senators in terms of most votes cast. And it was because I took the job seriously, tried to be there on the floor for each vote, each amendment, and in committee, either as chairman or a ranking member for many years, to fashion legislation and to conduct hearings that would be very helpful for the United States.
I know this is a difficult question given 36 years of service, but of those years in the Senate, what is the issue, you know, the piece of legislation or whatever of which you are the most proud or in which you take the most satisfaction?
I think the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act was the most important opportunity that I had. It came about simply because Sam Nunn and I had been visiting with Russians during trips abroad from the time of the first Geneva talks in 1986, first opportunity in which people were actually thinking about reducing nuclear weapons. By 1991, when the Soviet Union broke apart, Russians actually came to the office of Sam Nunn and around a round table that I've inherited. We talked to the Russians and they said, "You've got a real problem because our military forces are breaking down. The weapons that are aimed at you may not have any guards around them, and something terrible might happen to you. So we have a problem, but you've got a bigger problem." And I said, "What do you want?" And they said, "Well, we're going to need a lot of your money. We're going to need a lot of your expertise in tearing down the weapons and the missiles and all the rest of it. And we may even need some of your troops by the time we're finished." Now, in that rather historic, sobering conversation, Sam Nunn and I found at least the possibilities for legislation, which in a very bipartisan way we passed in the final days of the 1991 Senate session, to give the first $400 million of appropriated money to the president to begin this process. Now, the president didn't know what to do with the money, and therefore we had to take some more trips, taking members of the administration to Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and what have you, so we could all get religion together. But what I'm saying is this started a process that over 20 years of time took out an estimated 8,000 to 10,000 nuclear warheads that were aimed at the United States, all of our military installations, all of our urban areas. Specifically, there were weapons, I believe, from historical records we tried to maintain, that were aimed at Indianapolis that could have annihilated the whole city. But during the period I was mayor, I had no idea we were under the gun in that way, nor did the other citizens of Indianapolis. But that was the case. And so this was very serious business that went on for 20 years and required annual and often more frequent trips to the former Soviet Union to track down what was happening, to make certain everything was on course. Endless appropriation battles on the Senate floor to make sure the money was there each year without all sorts of rigorous stipulations that would have killed the program or delayed it. I go into all this detail because it was not simply a piece of legislation, but it was a program that devolved from that I believe made a fundamental difference in the security of the United States today.
You've mentioned your friendship partnership with Sam Nunn several times. Did his post-Senate career provide a kind of model or example for you of a way that following the Senate you could still pursue work that has meaning and significance on the issues that you care about?
Yes, Sam worked with others to produce the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which is an organization made up of international leaders. By that I mean there are on the board of that on which I serve and have from the beginning of the organization people from China, from Russia, from India, from Japan, from the Middle East, all of whom have an interest in nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, in other words, any weapon of mass destruction, how these weapons are to be tracked and controlled, and in many cases destroyed progressively. Sam, I think, has done a great job with that organization. And by fashioning this international board, we have very frank conversations. Most recently, I attended a board meeting here in Washington of the board, and the Russians who were on the board were arguing their position with regard to Ukraine, for example. Now, This is quite outside nuclear weapons, but it does offer a forum, again, in which people have a chance to talk to each other and to understand each other's position, but likewise to make arguments that are very, very important, perhaps, in terms of international relations with the United States.
If you are just joining us, we are in the midst of a pre-recorded special conversation one-on-one with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. Senator Lugar, I'd like to talk now, switch to talking about foreign policy challenges. Obviously, there are some hot spots around the globe. But before we get to those individually, I'd like to ask you to give us an overview, at least, of where you think, what the great challenges confronting the United States in the world are right now. And then we'll go to some of the more specific pieces of that following the overview.
Well, fundamentally, we have both an opportunity as well as a challenge to keep a fleet at sea all of the time, really covering all of the oceans of the world that make it possible for American trade to occur, that make it possible for us to be alert and to respond to physical difficulties wherever they may be. We need to maintain physically an armed force that has the mobility to go any place on Earth at any time. At this particular stage in history, we are the only country that has that mobility. We're the only country that has the fleet that I've described. Now, the question for the United States, then, is to attempt to maintain domestic strength so that we can pay for this, so that we do not have economic hurdles that lead to drawdowns of the armed forces that we need or of the mobility that we need to have. We also need to encourage the inventive genius of Americans to continue working in cyberspace. The wars of the next few years could occur through cyber attack, quite apart from the normal functions of the military at sea or on land. And there are all sorts of ways we could come into conflict. I start this way because you can go through a long list of particular areas where there is conflict now and in which the interests of the United States may be involved. Specifically, we are trying to shore up NATO again, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It has brought about peace in Europe for 50 years, unparalleled, really, in the last millennium. Very important. But it's always challenged by the fact that the Russians, on occasion, may become more aggressive, as they have with regard to Ukraine presently. And that is a battle that not only involves Ukraine and Russia, but likewise, because Ukraine has signed up with the European Union, all of Europe. There are problems clearly in the Far East. We've talked about a pivot in terms of our foreign policy interest because the Chinese have grown, and they have threatened at least the countries around them, Japan, the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam are examples of countries that feel threatened by the Chinese moving their military and their thoughts about having oil wells or dominion over certain sea lanes or islands or what have you, to the point in which there could be actual warfare or conflict in the Far East on many grounds. There are a huge number of problems arising from the so-called Arab Spring, in which, starting with Tunisia, then spreading through Libya and Egypt and Syria, and now a huge dilemma posed by the problems in Iraq, which involved nearby Iran, quite apart from Syria, and everybody else in the neighborhood, and the problems specifically mentioning Iran of the potential development of nuclear weapons, a problem that already is on the world's face in North Korea and unable at least to have been controlled by the Chinese or the South Koreans or the near neighbors there. In Africa, quite apart from the northern part of Africa and the Arab Spring, endless conflicts as people attempt to find some stability for life, some progress. And here the United States has been extremely helpful, as have been other nations. But all of this will not go away from our conscience, because sometimes these nations with instability become havens for al-Qaeda or al-Shabaab or various other terrorist organizations that, as we know now from our history at 9/11, could threaten us.
Is this role, as you say, we're the only nation left in the world that can maintain the sort of fleet, the sort of global presence that we do, is that primarily a blessing or a curse for the United States?
I believe it's a blessing, and it ought to be interpreted that way, because it's clearly in our interest to have these contacts peacefully with nations all over the world. It clearly is in our economic interest, in our balance of payments, to be able to ensure American businesses that want to export food or machinery or electronics or whatever we have all over the world, that they're going to have safe passage, that the seas will remain open for that commerce. It gives opportunities for the rest of the world really to learn more about the United States, to enjoy some knowledge of what we have. I believe that the ability to be able to transport troops everywhere is absolutely essential, because the world is a big place and it is going to become more and more difficult to reach various places under certain battle conditions. So the sophistication of that mobility is also important and grows more so all the time. But it means that the United States is involved in the rest of the world. We are able to serve others, able to make a difference in the lives of others. So in addition to defending ourselves, the nobility of the spirit of the American people is expressed by our foreign assistance, by our assistance in bringing about new thoughts about democracy, human rights, rights for women and men and children, rights at least that are not a part of the ethic of every country, and we are not about to impose our conditions on every country, but we can make them available because we believe that there is a uniqueness in the history of America and the developments we have, and that we would like to share that.
What is the single greatest threat to the United States right now, the one thing we need to keep our eye on at all costs?
I suppose the greatest threat is the problem of a surprise attack, surprise in the sense not only of where it comes from, the nature of the tragedy that is visited upon the United States, but likewise the predicament it may cause in the rest of the world if the United States is attacked. I really cannot name or begin to suggest precisely where the attacks may come from, although more and more of our defense posture is coming down now to the intelligence services, an attempt to ferret out precisely who is where that has an interest in destruction of citizens of our property of the United States. And likewise, then, the use of drone aircraft, of mobile aircraft that don't require troops in regiment condition to land on the ground, to destroy at least the perpetrators of potential crimes against the United States of America. Because of the unknown quantity of this, in other words, you can see large countries, China, Russia, for example, but these are not currently countries that have an interest in attacking the United States, nor do they have really the military ability to attack and to win wars against the United States. It's the unknown situations of terrorist groups, of people who have a religious conviction that impels them to kill others even to kill themselves, to go into suicide bombings and strategies. And that is new, at least relatively, in terms of the quantity of it in the world, and this is what our major challenge is.
We are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar here on No Limits in a special pre-recorded conversation. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking a special one-on-one conversation with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar, pre-recorded, so we're not taking calls, emails, or social media questions today. And before the break, we were talking really about the overview, what the great opportunities and threats in terms of foreign policy and America's relationship with the rest of the world might be. Senator Lugar, obviously the two spots that are claiming most of at least the public attention these days are Iraq and the situation you alluded to. In regard to Ukraine and Russia's involvement there, I'd like to start with Iraq, and I'm going to ask a fairly pointed question. I mean, is there any way to avoid conflict or something resembling a civil war there?
No, there is not any way of avoiding that. However, there may be ways of mitigating the disaster. By that, I mean limiting the amount of conflict in due course. But for the moment, the Iraqi military, their formal governmental situation, really lacks the support within Iraq that is required to defend some major areas, quite apart from retaking those that have been taken over by the so-called ISIS, ISIS, the terrorist group coming over principally from Syria, having now mounted the borders between Syria and Iraq in such a way that they are claiming they're going to establish their own government. I think in addition to that, there is the fact that it's been very difficult for the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds in Iraq to unify to some degree. At the same time that some are suggesting, particularly in the Kurdish area, that this may be their opportunity for independence from all of it. This would be, of course, a huge cutoff of oil resources that are in Kurdistan, quite apart from a good part of the country disappearing. In other words, some are saying, after all these boundaries were really established, after World War I, essentially, by Europeans who were not really attempting to draw boundaries to take into consideration the various religious sects, but simply lump folks together with the thought that they would have to make it. And in fact, there has been a degree of civil strife, if not war, in Iraq really from the beginning, because the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis simply did not get along with each other. At some point, one or the other has been dominant. In the case of Saddam Hussein, it was the Sunnis in Iraq. His overthrow has led to the Shiites coming forward. But without acceptance by many Sunnis, who have some welcomed the terrorists coming in, much to their regret, perhaps, as they will find. So for a period of time, the United States has sent a limited number of troops there to defend our embassy in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, and perhaps to simply survey what the possibilities are for some degree of diplomacy, some ability of the three parts of the country to come together to reject the ISIS group, and then to figure out really what to do with the ISIS group, which is a terror situation in Syria, a situation that you did not mention among the current predicaments, Ukraine and Iraq, but bobs up, of course, from time to time as to problems in some of the countries that were part of the Arab Spring.
Was it a mistake for us to invade Iraq?
In retrospect, it may well have been. It is now, I think, beside the point to keep arguing that and assigning blame to whoever was back and forth in it, because at the time there were at least well-founded rumors that Saddam Hussein was developing nuclear weapons. We had been over in the area, as you recall, to defend Kuwait against invasion by Iraq earlier on. And during that time in debates in the Congress, sometimes people said, well, this is, as George Bush said, we're defending sovereignty. Well, I think Secretary Jim Baker at one point said we're defending oil. And what he meant was that the United States was involved in that war because Saudi Arabia was next door, the Kuwaitis themselves had a lot of oil, and the American dependence upon Middle Eastern oil was such that our economy would not function very well without at least those resources that had been guaranteed all the way back from Franklin Roosevelt's first talks with the Saudis. So oil was always a part of it, but at the same time, the nuclear weapons threat offered at least the spur for military action. Now, since it turned out the rumors were wrong and we attacked, then history begins to record a lot of problems and the number of mistakes that surrounded this, winding up finally with a situation in which, with our having helped the Iraqis establish a democracy, they literally decided we don't want you around anymore. And there are a good number of Iraqis today who would say that. The thought that we will come to the rescue in Iraq is not an acceptable situation for many parts of that country now.
Senator, if you were president right now, what policy would you be advocating for in regard to Iraq and the situation there now?
If I were president, I would continue the thought that we are going to protect the American embassy and American interests, but at the same time, study very carefully how diplomacy could work, because it has to work eventually. The parliament has been tied up, the leadership situations likewise, but there has to be some acceptance by Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds of the governance, of a unified governance of the country. Absent that, there will continually be fighting, and there will be nothing we can do to prevent it. The thought that somehow the United States could come in, even with other allies, occupy the country, tell everybody to settle down, in essence, govern the country until we decided once again to leave, and people were at it again. This is just something that has to evolve with the Iraqis. Now, at the same time, we're going to have to be very thoughtful about how this is affecting the potential for the Syrians to have any degree of peace over there, quite apart from this ISIS group setting up a new state in the middle of all of this, and what the effect of all of this is with regard to our relations with Iran, with regard to our relations, and as a matter of fact, with countries that surround all of the above that have been accepting hundreds of thousands of refugees that now go into the millions that have fled out of Syria to begin with and are now fleeing Iraq in great numbers. There is potential there for us to give assistance through foreign aid. I saw that recently the Saudis have sent $500 million to the United Nations just to provide some sustenance for Iraqis who are fleeing the country. But it is going to be a huge humanitarian difficulty until there is some reconciliation through diplomacy and some stability of governance.
If you are just joining us here on No Limits, we are in the middle of an in-depth one-on-one conversation with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We're now sort of surveying the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. We'd also mentioned, Senator Lugar, the situation in Ukraine, and Russia's more aggressive posture there. Give us your thoughts, if you would, on how the United States should approach that situation and what the United States' role might be.
Well, first of all, looking at it from the standpoint of the new government in Ukraine with an elected leader, elected parliament, they have done a great job having a free and fair election in the midst of conflict, but they face bankruptcy. Now, they've staved that off by getting the support of the European Union and the World Bank and other situations who have loaned the money. But at the same time, whether it's a $14 or $15 billion debt, it's well beyond their capacity. Meanwhile, the Russians have said we are going to cut off natural gas supplies and we're going to charge you more when and if you ever pay, and we renew those. And then furthermore, although we would welcome from time to time a ceasefire, we reserve the right to defend Russians who are in eastern Ukraine, Russian citizens. So this puts renewed pressure upon not only Ukraine to finally recapture the rest of its country, having lost Crimea, but under the dint of Russians coming across the border and organizing, some Russians who are in Ukraine, who really like Russia better than Ukraine for that matter, and have occupied city halls and what have you. Now, in the midst of all of this, the United States has moved cautiously because we believe we could impose economic sanctions on Russia that would really be very tough for the Russian economy and therefore create some instability, if that can be a cause, for Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader. The Europeans have cautioned us against doing that because they have business interests with Russia, not only natural gas, 30% of their natural gas in Western Europe comes from Russia, but likewise all sorts of manufacturing goods and intellectual property and what have you. So they said, go easy now on the sanctions. How long we can go easy is a matter of perspective. But the fact is that we are going to have to continue to put genuine pressure on Russia. We're going to have to continue to make certain that Ukraine has some breathing room for their new government to get formulated, for some economy at least to occur that might bring growth and jobs to them, and for their new relationship as a sign up with the European Union to work out, hopefully bringing some support from those European countries.
You've long been a strong and articulate advocate for international cooperation. Could you maybe talk a little bit, because there have been voices in this country with Ukraine, and particularly in terms of confronting President Putin, who've been arguing for unilateral action on the part of the United States. In what circumstances should the United States act unilaterally? I'm assuming from talking with you over the years, you'd put severe limits on that, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
I believe we have to act unilaterally when United States property or our armed forces are attacked by somebody. We have the right to defend ourselves. Now, with regard to working out the problems of other countries, we have treaties with many countries in which we are pledged to come to their support. And that's been a factor, for instance, in our pivot to Asia, our thought that we have come to support the Philippines, staving off Chinese assertions that they have hegemony over certain islands out there. We have taken now a strong position in the ASEAN alliance, and that's the countries in Southeast Asia Indonesians very appreciative of that. We are certainly very supportive of South Korea, a very strong alliance there and very strong alliance with Japan. Now, these alliances have potential hazards to them in the event of aggression and attacks, in the same way that from the beginning of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, we have an obligation under Article 5 to come to the rescue of any country, any European country that's a member of NATO, along with the United States and Canada, the North Atlantic Alliance. And that would mean that in the event that there was invasion, France, by Russia, we would have to come to their rescue to retain that country, retain their sovereignty. So we have these treaty obligations that we take very seriously, and so do the countries that are protected by us.
I'd like to ask real quickly, what was in maybe 30 seconds or so, what was the most difficult foreign policy challenge for you? I mean, obviously, you were in the nuclear disarmament in the Philippines, in a host of foreign policy confrontations over the years. You were a major player and generally a voice of reconciliation. What one was the most difficult for you personally?
I suppose getting back to Iraq at the very beginning, I was working with Senator Biden. He was either chairman and I was ranking member, or the other way around, a foreign relations committee to work out some situation that did not lead to the United States going to war at that point. Now, our efforts were overtaken by others in the Congress, and eventually things stumbled along until there was a congressional resolution, and never a declaration of war.
Then the sort of last area I'd like to take this into is asking Senator Lugar what you hope your legacy will be. We're talking about a career that now spans nearly a half century of public service, continues in a different capacity. You're not working in politics anymore, but is still a form of public service. What do you hope people will remember?
I hope they will remember that I appreciated very deeply the opportunities for public service that came from elections of my friends and neighbors in Indianapolis and Indiana throughout the years. The opportunities for service gave me advantages to try to tackle what I saw were very difficult human problems, whether they were in the case of nutrition or arms control or better governance, democracy and human rights. These were things that were very important in my consciousness and in my life, and the opportunity really to have political offices and at least the authority to make a difference meant a great deal to me, and I appreciated that opportunity very much.
Senator Lugar, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. I've enjoyed talking with you. And I also would like to thank our listeners. You've been listening to a special edition of No Limits, pre-recorded, in-depth conversation with Senator Lugar. We'll be back next week. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And board engineer Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.